The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Welcome back, everybody. We've certainly had an exciting day thus far with a very strong academic focus on our subject, three very solid panels, and two very solid speakers. But this panel, not to put too much pressure on these folks, this is the real payoff panel. This is the one that builds upon all the knowledge you've gained on what's been covered the day thus far and sort of blue skies it, so to speak. That's an expression of just thinking about what should be, what ought to be, what could be. And you might notice that that thematically comports with the bright blue sky color of our program agenda today. That's not any accident. We don't do anything quite by accident around here at AU Law School. These folks here are going to try to put their heads together and come up with what they think makes the most sense, all things taken into consideration. And we're very, very lucky. We have our fourth faculty member as our moderator today, and I'll just mention that Steve Vladek is one of the most distinguished members of our faculty, even at a very young age. Yes, he's a full professor before age 30, believe it or not, and that's saying something in the world of academia. And now I'm a little bit biased because he and I are writing a secrecy textbook together that will certainly cover the state secrets privilege and perhaps might even quote some of the folks that are speaking here today. So without taking up any more time, let me turn you over to Professor Vladek, and we'll take it from there.
Great. Thanks, Dan. Thank you all for sticking around for this long in the day. We are, as someone once famously said, reaching the point in the proceedings where everything has been said, but not everyone has said it. And so in that sense, part of our job is to say everything that's been said previously today, but better, or at least in pithier sound bites. Anyway, Dan already introduced the idea behind the panel. I am going to very briefly introduce the participants in the panel and then turn it over to them. Our format is going to be brief opening statements followed by moderated dialogue so we can actually try to fight with each other and come up with some consensus on what the right answer actually is. With regard to the speakers, starting immediately to my right is Liza Goitein, who is the director of the Liberty and National Security Project. I should have known that anyway. At the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. To her right is Ken Goody, who's the associate director for the Center for American Progress. To Ken's right is Carl Nichols, formerly the principal deputy associate attorney general in the Civil Division at the Department of Justice, and a last-minute stand-in for Jeff Buchholz. Thank you very much, Carl. To Carl's right, last but certainly not least, is Kent Roach, who is the Pritchard Wilson Chair of Law and Public Policy on the Faculty of Law at the University of Toronto. So we have a fantastic group of people to take up the question of just what, in an idealized world, the state secrets privilege should look like. So with that, I'll turn it over to Liza.
Thanks, Steve. I also want to thank the Washington College of Law for hosting this event, and of course, Dan for putting it together. It's great to be on this terrific panel. I was actually going to talk about one thing, and then I totally changed my mind when I heard Don Verley speak earlier today. And I realized that what I really need to talk about is how I think, ideally, the state secrets privilege regime needs to reaffirm the importance of this being an evidentiary privilege. And I'm not talking here about the distinction between an evidentiary privilege and a non-justiciability doctrine, which we have heard about already. So this is not about whether or not the privilege attaches to evidence versus to a case or to subject matter. Rather, this is about whether or not evidence attaches to, the privilege attaches to an item of evidence or to the facts that are contained in that document or testimony or other item of evidence. And I think there's been a real and, to me, disturbing trend toward asserting the privilege over facts that are contained in the evidence rather than the evidence itself. And I would direct you to the recent filing of this administration in the Schubert case. And I'll just quickly read you a couple quotes. Quickly, if I can find it. So here's one quote from the brief. As set forth below, the facts needed for plaintiffs to establish standing or litigate the merits of all their claims against all defendants are subject to the DNI's privilege assertion. On the very next page, here the DNI has properly asserted privilege over facts essential for the plaintiffs to establish their standing. Now, it's obvious to me why the government would want to do that, because at the outset of a case, you don't know what the evidence is. It is just a prediction. Whereas you can, with much more certainty, say what facts are going to be necessary to litigate the privilege. So it's to the government's advantage in that sense to portray this as a privilege that attaches to facts rather than evidence. I think that the Ninth Circuit panel in Jeppesen got this one exactly right. And I'm not just saying that because Judge Hawkins was the judge that I clerked for. The panel held that the evidentiary privileges attach to evidence and not to facts. And the example that the panel gave was the privilege against self-incrimination. And the example that while a person may not be forced to present certain facts about his or her own guilt, that those facts can be established through some other kind of evidence. Now, I fully appreciate that the relationship between the reason for the state secrets privilege and the facts that are in the document is a much closer relationship with the state secrets privilege than it is with self-incrimination. But I think it would be a real mistake to collapse them entirely for two reasons. And the first reason is that there are going to be situations where there are two pieces of evidence that contain the same facts, and in one context the evidence will be subject to state secrets and the other it will not. And the prototypical example is information that is contained only in a government-generated document that is classified versus that same information if a person happens, a plaintiff, happens to know it from firsthand experience or information. And in the second setting, the reason for the privilege really evaporates because that person can go out on the street corner and tell everybody what they know, and it's going to have the same effect on national security as if they say it in court, because it's not as if they're the government or as if there's any official confirmation of it. So there's no reason to allow it in one situation and not the other. But the second reason that I think that that we have to keep that distinction is because the logic of asserting privilege over facts goes beyond the courtroom. If in fact, that to me is where things get really scary. So if the government can assert privilege over truths and remove them from the public domain, then there's no logical reason why the government shouldn't also be saying that that person, in the example I just gave, should not be allowed to go out on the street corner and tell people what they know through their own firsthand experience. I don't even want to call it a slippery slope because it's sort of the logical extension, and it may sound fanciful or paranoid, but we're starting to see some of that already. If you look at, for example, the Guantanamo detainee cases, where the government has taken the position that what happened to what these detainees know happened to them, which is information they know firsthand, not through any, either authorized or unauthorized access to government information, is classified. And to me, that's a very dicey and dangerous proposition. So I guess I'll leave it there. I did want to talk a little bit about a totally separate issue, which is whether or not in this sort of blue sky world, I think there ought to be a balancing test between sort of national security and the public interest. But I think what I should do is wait and maybe hopefully get to that later on.
Great. Next slide, then. Ken?
Thanks very much, Steve. And I just want to extend also my Thanks to Dan for putting together such a fantastic program here today. To my fellow panelists, it's an honor and privilege to be up here with you, and especially to all of you who've sat through an entire day and now just have us left to listen to. I'm sure that we will try and be brief, and we will try and keep your attention as best we can. I'm going to try and focus on three things. One, which I think Liza covered very well, is the issue of evidence, and so I'll probably just leave that and move right on into my second and third points. My second one is to focus on this question of institutional competence and capacity. And the real and I think legitimate concern on the part of the executive that the judges in federal district court around the country apply the standard in very different ways and have different levels of competence about whether or not they are about assessing classified or national security information. And that may make the executive reluctant to open themselves up to what could be some inconsistent rulings. And I've gone through a variety of different ways to try and solve this one, most of them pretty wacky. Something like moving every case that at least the state secrets portion of the case into the FISA court, which everybody told me was the stupidest idea they'd ever heard. So I quickly discarded that one. Or creating some kind of a special litigation panel or a special master process to then hear the claims of state secrets and make a recommendation to the judge about whether or not that's an appropriate assertion on the part of the government. But that seemed a little bit impractical and a little bit hard to manage, and again would still not really satisfy concerns about inconsistent application. And so what I settled on, and I'm happy to debate this, and I'm happy to also have you all tell me it's dumb, is to select in each particular federal jurisdiction one judge that would hear cases involving state secrets claims. This one judge would be selected partially because of their experience in national security matters, but also could then be receive additional training in classified information and intelligence information, and would develop a greater level of expertise with the issue as part of their portfolio. I think this would help the matters with the administration perspective, with an executive perspective on whether or not the particular judges would rule inconsistently. But I also think it has a follow-on benefit, and that if the government is consistently going to the same judge and making a claim of state secrets, there is going to be an added incentive for the government not to make frivolous claims. They will be required to maintain their credibility with the court in a similar way that the Justice Department is required to make to maintain their credibility with the FISA court. I think that's a very strong internal check on excessive application of state secrets or abuse or application of the state secrets privilege merely to cover up government misconduct. Because should the Justice Department or whoever makes the claim be found to have simply chosen to assert state secrets as a means of covering up embarrassing facts or misconduct, their future applications to that particular judge would most likely be held with a very low level of credibility. And then lastly, I'd like to turn very briefly to the question of oversight. I caught a little bit of the last panel discussing how Congress can get involved, and I think if I accurately caught how they felt, or at least some of them felt, that it was difficult to expect Congress to legislate particularly stringent standards. I think that's probably true, given the experience that we've had with this particular Congress and previous Congresses on how they handle complex national security law questions. But where I think Congress can and should get more involved is on the oversight question and require much more significant oversight. And so my proposal on this would be to build off of what Attorney General Holder mentioned in his, it's a very small part of the September 23rd policy, which is that if there's an instance of government misconduct that comes up in a case where they may be asserting the state secrets privilege, that particular government misconduct is then referred to the Inspector General. Well, I think that's an all well and good intention, but My recommendation would be to require an Inspector General report on an annual basis of every application for the state secrets privilege that's then communicated to Congress as well. I think that if we look back at the history of particularly how we learned about a lot of the problems and applications of some of the Patriot Act authority, most of what we learned came from the very good work of DOJ Inspector General Glenn Fine. And if we could make the same kinds of, or at least build in some of the same kinds of processes into the application of the state secrets, we might learn a lot about that as well. And I think I'll conclude my remarks from there, and I look forward to rigorous debate and questions.
Great. Thanks, Ken. Carl?
Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Dan, also for having me. I'll keep my remarks very brief. I know it's late and people have been here all day. I was not here for the earlier panels. So I don't know if there was any debate about this particular question, particular issue I'm about to raise first, but it seems, at least implicit in the topic that we're discussing, that there is general agreement, maybe even unanimous agreement, that there should be a privilege or a mechanism for protecting state secrets information in federal court. So at least there's a baseline, at least within this panel, that there should be such a privilege, which I think is important because it is the case, and it was my experience, that litigation in civil cases does risk at times the disclosure of information which, if disclosed, could really harm national security. So the fact that there is common agreement, I think, is very important. What should the privilege look like? I have a fair amount of experience having litigated several cases and also having been in the room when privilege assertions were discussed, even if it wasn't a case I was going to litigate. And people assume that Reynolds' requirement that the head of the agency needs to assert the privilege is, you know, important, but, you know, at the end of the day, perhaps window dressing. But in my view, that is actually a very important requirement. And I realize that, again, this is sort of a baseline among lots of people who discuss it. Certainly all the legislation I've ever seen that's been proposed requires the head of the agency to do it. But there's a reason for that, and that is if you're in an agency and you are required to go to the head of your agency and recommend that he or she take this very, very public and some view it as aggressive position under oath, you know, penalty of perjury attached to the signature, people are extremely careful, in my experience, in the agencies in what they will or will not recommend. And so what I saw was within the agencies that had control over the information that the requirement that the head of the agency assert the privilege actually leads to quite a lot of vetting and quite a lot of checks on the ultimate assertion. There's another check embodied in the system, and that is that the Department of Justice at some level also has to validate the assertion of the privilege. A lot of time the information is held by a particular agency, and so the agency head says, I want to assert the privilege, and DOJ has to also agree to assert the privilege because DOJ controls what can be said in litigation. So I think that is an important requirement embodied in Reynolds, and I sometimes think it gets short thrift. Very quickly, two other things that I think are pretty critical. One is the inappropriate cases, and that's an important qualifier, but inappropriate cases, the privilege should be able to be asserted upon the filing of a complaint and result in dismissal. And here's why. Answers are or can be evidentiary. And there are circumstances in which an answer, by confirming or denying allegations, would confirm or deny particular pieces of information, or call them facts, call them evidence. I don't think it really matters here, but the result would be the litigation would disclose information that would harm national security. So I think that it is important that at least in some circumstances you allow the privilege to be asserted and result in dismissal pre-answer. The second is, and I gather that there was quite a bit of discussion about this, and I therefore won't belabor the point now, but I think there are many good reasons why whatever the ultimately articulated standard for deciding whether a privilege assertion is proper or not, that in fact the judges should be deferring considerably to the considered judgment of the executive branch official who's asserting the privilege. Why? Because these are necessarily predictive judgments. This is not fact-finding. This is not the finding of a pre-existing fact. What it is, it's an executive branch official predicting that the disclosure of a piece of information will harm national security. That is a different kind of inquiry than judges typically make, and it is what our elected officials or executive branch officials, however you want to describe them, do for a living in the relevant agencies. Thanks.
Thanks, Carl.
Kent?
Yes, thank you. I also would like to thank the organizers, especially, I guess, as the foreigner. When we're talking about state secrets in an era of international terrorism, of course, we're talking also about other state secrets. So hopefully a bit of a global perspective is relevant here. I'm just going to quickly go through, and until the last panel it was only a top 9 list. Now I'm happy that it is a top 10 list, features that I think would be in an ideal State Secrets Act, only about half of which are in the House bill. A couple more are in the Attorney General's policy, but some I think actually haven't been discussed at all. So I'll spend more time, obviously, on those. Number one is inspection. The judge, I think, has to look at what is being claimed privilege over in this sense, and I think this came from Lewis Fisher's comments. Reynolds should be seen as a Cold War relic, and I think the bill would be helpful. Second, and here I think there is room for reasonable disagreement. My preference, and this is the way it's done in Canada, the UK, and Australia, is to allow an open balancing by the judge of the harm to national security versus the countervailing harms. As I understand your state secrets doctrine, it really is about definitional limits. Either it is a state secret or it isn't, as opposed to the balancing. And this is a little bit about, my preference for balancing is it does allow the judges to opine on things that they are undoubtedly experts on, that is, the need to apply the rule of law, openness, democracy, and to put that in the balance. But even if you disagree with that, you should be aware that many countries are going to balance it. So, you know, in Canada and the UK, this issue about whether there's due deference or utmost deference really isn't an issue, because in most cases the judge will take the state at its word. I mean, there's some testing that there's a harm to national security, but then we'll go on to the other side of the balance and the least restrictive means, the way to reconcile these competing interests. Number three, I think generally we need to modernize our thinking about state secrets to take account that we're out of the Cold War, a long time now, in an era of international terrorism that has been talked about as involving the judicialization of intelligence. So when an intelligence agency is up on suspected terrorists, overnight, or even quicker than that, you can get into the evidential stream. So I think it's very important that intelligence agencies rethink their own attitude towards secrecy, right? So the mosaic effect is very much a kind of Cold War concept where you're thinking that it's the KGB on the other side. Does that make the same sense? I'm not saying it makes no sense. Does it make the same sense when the enemy is Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda-inspired terrorism? Similarly, the issue of timing. Right? A lot of these are state secrets at point A, may not be a state secret at point B if the investigation has played out. So I like the idea that we heard about this morning about dismissing without prejudice, even tolling limitation periods. Similarly, the third party rule. That's a very important rule, but the Canadian courts have recognized that when the third-party rule applies, you should at least go back to the agency that originally gave you the information and ask them if they're going to amend their caveat. So there's a lot of, I think it's important that whatever the legislation is, it contemplates that secrecy and intelligence is rightly evolving. Fourth, and there has been no discussion of this, why don't we try to at least put some non-exhaustive definition of legitimate secrecies? Right now, in all of our legislation, we just refer to national secrecy, national defense, international relations, diplomatic relations, which is now in the Binyan Mohammed case in the UK, that's really becoming the hot issue, right? Why, if part of the reason is public education and public confidence, why don't we at least put a non-exhaustive list of legitimate secrets in there, as well, and this borrows from the Holder policy, what are illegitimate secrets, i.e. embarrassment for wrongdoing. I think part of the problem here is we just deal in the vague generalities of national security, national defense. Let's at least try to put a little bit of flesh on those bones. Number five, focus on least restrictive means, substitutions, admissions. That's done, relatively uncontroversial. Number six, adversarial challenge. I was somewhat disappointed that Mr. Varelli, because I really do admire the policy, but he really seemed very dismissive of SEPA-type adversarial challenges. And I guess my response to that is threefold. One, we've already heard leaks generally don't come from guardium ad litems, or what in Canada and in the United Kingdom would be called security-cleared special advocates. Two, special advocates don't need to talk to their client about whether it's a legitimate state secret. They need to talk to their client about the merits of the claim. But the special advocates in both Canada and Britain have been able, and this started with the Arar Commission, which I was part of, to push the government on overclaiming of secrets. And I do think that judges benefit from adversarial argument. And third, I think, and this was certainly our experience in the Arar Commission, judges are also capable of issuing both public judgments and classified judgments, and this puts some strain, but the idea that it's one, you know, that this will bring an era of secret courts, I think may be a little overblown. Seven, interlocutory appeals. Although I am opposed to interlocutory appeals in the criminal context, because the state can always dismiss, I think Heather rightly alluded to the importance of interlocutory appeals in a civil case that may not even involve the government. Number eight, promote judicial accountability about overclaiming. So if you put some flesh on the bones of what is a legitimate or illegitimate secret, then you will find that not only is there executive and legislative accountability, but potentially judicial accountability. Nine, Carl's made the point about the importance of the head of the agency, but I do think that the AG's role is important because the head of the agency is under oath. That is an important requirement. I would not dispense with it, but I think there is also a need for more of a whole of government approach to what should be kept secret and what isn't secret. And then last, I won't say very much about this because Kenneth's spoken about this, perhaps there is a role for specialized courts. And in Canada, for example, these cases are heard by specially designated judges, largely because of the secure facilities. Specialized judges do raise some fears about capture, but they also can can, as repeat players, gain an awful lot of experience and, in our experience, do not react kindly when they feel that they have that the government hasn't been completely candid with them. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Kent. It's always useful to be reminded that other countries have secrets, too. So I thought I'd sort of start our back and forth with a very sort of abstract question in the hope that it will provide grounds for disagreement and confrontation of the most amiable nature. And my question is about proxy monitors, right? So it seems like a lot of the fighting when it comes down to different views of the state secrets privilege is who the person who should have access to the real critical information is, right? Should it be a judge? Should it be a third party? Kent, you mentioned special security cleared lawyers who have presumably special training and special responsibilities. If we're trying to construct some kind of idealized view of the privilege, how small a universe or how large a universe of individuals do we want to actually have access to the relevant information, and for what purpose? I guess that's my broad open-ended question, and I invite any and all of you to jump in.
I'll take a crack. My first reaction was to say it depends. It depends on sensitive and important the information is. And that led me to, perhaps a hasty conclusion, and that is whatever regime you set up, because you would like to have clear rules in advance, whatever the rules are, I think those rules should be appropriate with respect to the most sensitive information you can imagine. Because you wouldn't want to set up a set of rules that would enable a large group of people to see incredibly sensitive information. I think that would be a far worse system than the alternative. So, that's a 30-second considered judgment.
I don't know whether in the United States there's publicly available data about the amount of people in the executive branch with security clearances. There are in Canada, and it's a very, very large number. So, but I also take Steve's question about what are the skill sets that you want of this monitor. And I do think that you need, both security intelligence expertise, but also a kind of general sense of fairness. And so, I think that we're talking about perhaps judge and co, right? So a judge either who has that experience or a judge who's assisted by a special master. In Britain, the SEAC had judges as well as people with experience in security intelligence. But I really think that you need both, because if you just have one, then there are dangers both ways.
I would just add one thing to that, which is that I think that people often forget the value of adversariality, not just to fairness and due process, but to getting to the truth. And that generally, it's the best, with due respect, it's one of the best systems any country has come up with for getting to the truth is the adversarial system that we have. One-sided presentations of the evidence rarely get to the truth quite as well. So I think to the extent we want to get to the right answers in these cases, I think you want to try to open it up as broadly as you can, consistent with national security. And I would say that at a minimum, that it certainly involves the judge seeing the evidence, and in sort of the most extreme case, maybe a guardian ad litem who is pre-cleared and from a select list. And then there may be other cases on a case-by-case basis where it's also appropriate to extend it to maybe the plaintiff's counsel if they've had clearance and that sort of thing. But I think it's important for getting to the truth. I think it's also important because, another point to remember is that, yes, the government has a tremendous amount of expertise in this area. But first of all, they're not the only ones. There are people outside of the government who have expertise in this area, maybe people who were previously in the government and now are not, who can be called in as experts. But second of all, the government also is self-interested. And generally speaking, when you have an expert witness in any other scenario, come in and testify, you're going to find out about what his interest in the case is. And if somebody comes up in civil litigation, an expert witness, and discloses during voir dire, discloses to the court that they have a direct interest in the outcome of the case, then the judge is going to weigh their testimony with a little more skepticism than they would otherwise. I think that's appropriate here as well. So there are all kinds of reasons why I think you do want to open it up to as many people as you responsibly can, but then I think there will be case-by-case limits on that, and then in some cases it might be as few as two people, the judge and guardian ad litem.
Could I just maybe, not really disagreeing, but maybe we could debate a little bit whether you could create a form of an adversarial process without going to the plaintiff attorney. Whether you could set up a system with a judge and the guardian or however you want to set up the system, where the they interact in a way that substitutes for an adversarial system.
So sort of like an amicus.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean to say that it's a perfect substitute for it, but what I do mean to say is there may actually be cases in which the national security interests are such that you might have to accept that trade-off a little bit. But I don't think you can sort of make hard and fast rules up front about what that situation is going to be. I think you need to look case by case and say, is this a case where we can, you know, involve the plaintiff's counsel? Or for whatever reason, and I don't want to sort of speculate about what those reasons will be, but I think the judge is the right person to make that decision. And the judge can decide, you know, in this case, the national security interests are such that even though there will be some reduction in the adversariality, we're going to limit it to a guardian ad litem.
Carl, you wanted to pitch in?
Two quick points. And this first point was probably covered in earlier panels, and if so, forgive this. But it seems to me, at least in talking to some friends and some folks who haven't lived in this world, there's a misconception about the practice of asserting the privilege, that people think that the department or the government goes to a judge and says, this information covered by the complaint is privileged, you must dismiss, and we're not going to tell you what it is. We're not going to tell you why the disclosure of that information would harm national security. In my experience, that was never the case. The government always provided judge with extensive information about what was being covered by the privilege and the reasons for the argument or the position that the disclosure of that information would harm national security. And we're talking about very robust declarations, often with supporting evidence. So my view is the judge is an appropriate person to receive this information. The question is who else? And the second question or second point is it's sort of a question, and that is to ask, what is an adversarial proceeding designed to do here? The ultimate question a judge has to assess is whether the government has made a case that the disclosure of this information would harm national security. Whether the government's predictive judgment is a reasonable one or is a correct one depends what standard you think is appropriate. And if that is the question about which you think there should be adversarial proceedings, it's a little different than your traditional adversarial proceeding where what you're thinking about is getting at an existing fact. And at the very least, as you think about this question, and I think it's a pretty fundamental question about whether you need adversarialness in this process, you have to remember that the ultimate question is different from your traditional trial where the question is, you know, did X occur?
Could I just say one thing to that? I'm not totally sure I agree with that, and part of that is because in any civil litigation, you're kind of in some ways talking about a predictive judgment, which is, you know, preponderance of the evidence. Is it more likely than not that a law was violated? You're not saying as a complete and total fact. You're saying what is the likelihood, and you're looking at the facts and the evidence to see if it supports that sort of judgment that it's more likely than not that there is a violation of the law in this case. And I think that's certainly analogous, if not identical. But I'm not saying it's identical. But I think it's perfectly analogous to saying, are the facts and the evidence before the court sufficient to sustain this predictive judgment. And I think in that case, the adversariality is important because the other side, the government may give the court all the facts that the government thinks is important, but the other side may think there are other facts that are important. They can bring in an expert witness to present some other facts to the court that may alter the analysis.
I would say it's almost more important in a situation when you're talking about a prediction to have an adversarial process, or at least as close to an adversarial process as you can, because what you're debating about is something that may happen in the future. And one side's argument is not necessarily the full picture, and even maybe more so in that particular case. So I would think it's more important.
Although, I guess in a sense, right, that's counterbalanced by the FISA experience, right, where you're making a predictive judgment about the potential, about the need to sort of, you know, will someone have useful information at this place at this time, right? That's the most sort of non-adversarial process we have.
I'm not sure I follow you.
Sure, that the probable cause determination in the FISA context is a predictive judgment,
right,
where the FISA court judges typically defer pretty extensively. I mean, I've never litigated in front of the FISA court, but they defer to the executive branch, and it's non-adversarial.
Well, I mean, but that was my point, and I think there are some fairly strong critiques out there about the non-adversariality of the FISA process. Kent, let me sort of see if I can throw a question down your way. I mean, so Ken was suggesting the possibility, not so much of special courts per se, but of sort of, you know, individually specialized magistrates. I'm curious, right, if you see that as a useful way of balancing the interest here to sort of have special local judges who are specially trained to handle these kinds of cases.
Yeah, well, I mean, that has been the experience in Canada. And I guess, I mean, opinions vary on it. There is some concern that specially designated judges who are just, you know, continually seeing either FISA-style warrants or national security confidentiality proceedings, all involving the intelligence agency, may get captured by the worldview of the intelligence agency. So some would argue that that is a danger. I think more recently, though, what we've seen, and I think in large part because of the special advocates have been pushing, is we've seen a number of these specially designated judges slam the government for not making full disclosure that is relevant in their judgment to the decision. So I think it is a trade-off, but I do think that there is a case for kind of the institutional expertise. Another thing I would just kind of briefly mention, and this might be a non-starter in the United States, I don't know how it would affect Article 3, but there is a safety net in Canada because the Attorney General now has a statutory right to intervene even after a court order for disclosure and prevent the disclosure of information. And this was a very controversial provision that was put into our post 9/11 Anti-Terrorism Act, and many people opposed it at the time, and I was very concerned about it. So far, the Attorney General of Canada has not used that once, but I do think in retrospect it does provide a safety valve. And if you're talking about, you know, I think Louis Fisher mentioned that there's always going to be judicial deference to the executive in national security areas, I wonder whether that has been one of the factors as judges have made a series of rulings that favor greater disclosure, that they know that if the agency really goes to the wall and says, look, you know, the Americans, the Brits are going to turn off the tap if this actually happens, that the Attorney General can take the extraordinary step of certifying non-disclosure even after a court has, under the balance, ordered there to be disclosure.
I mean, is it possible that in the American system, the ability of the government to take an immediate interlocutory appeal serves much the same purpose?
Yes, and I mean, criminally, you always have the dismissal. But what if you lose the interlocutory appeal? So, I mean, I think that...
With this Supreme Court?
Pardon me?
With this Supreme Court?
I think you need the ability, and maybe you would have to put it in any legislation, if there were going to be legislation, that there would be an automatic stay. Because I think the risk is if the district court orders disclosure, the right to take an appeal gives you an appeal, but it doesn't give you the right to have a stay. And it's the stay that you need. It's the stay of the disclosure order. And so, you know, if you're worried about making sure the executive branch has a way to protect itself, I mean, yes, courts of appeals typically grant these stays, but it's not automatic.
And I would suspect there probably wouldn't be too much disagreement about that in this room, even.
Yeah.
No. We're all proceduralists.
Exactly.
It just makes sense.
There's an automatic stay in the Canadian legislation when there's an indoor. You
know, the one thing I would add on the question of, and maybe this will just generate more debate, and it's probably a debate that was already had, so I'll stop saying that, I guess. But the question of adversariality really gets to the question of what's the ultimate role that you think the decision maker should be undertaking. I mean, if the judge is ultimately supposed to grant the utmost deference to the executive, it's not clear to me that adversariality is ultimately all that important. If you think the judge should be either, making an independent assessment, then maybe adversariality makes a lot more sense. And then, you know, if you think the judge should be somewhere in the middle there, then you can talk about gradations of adversariality. So I think it's difficult to talk about adversariality without answering the perhaps ultimate question of what's the judge's role. And, you know, I said earlier that I think it should be considerable deference or, you know, substantial deference, but I suspect others here disagree with that.
Can I push back, though, on one? I mean, I guess
one
of the questions I've always had about the state secrets context is, even as we are confronting questions that we haven't necessarily expressly grappled with before, there is longer experience with other privileges, right, that often raise maybe not identical, but at least analogous and comparable concerns about disclosure, about the risk of information getting out, about the sort of irreparable harm that could result. Are there lessons to learn from these other contexts that we've been neglecting? Right? I mean, are there lessons to learn from executive privilege cases, from trade secrets cases, right, which is, you know, which I think actually raises quite comparable harms, albeit in the private sector versus the public sector?
Well, I think it obviously depends on the privilege context you're talking about. I think in certain contexts, the determination, the judicial determination relevant in the privilege context is more of the preponderance question. It's a more fact-based inquiry than a predictive judgment of the kind that applies in the state secrets context. And, you know, yes, trade secrets is somewhat analogous, but I do think that the harm from a trade secrets case is to the company, and I think ultimately, the question in a state secrets case is a more fundamental one about harm to national security. I think on the other side of the V or the other side of the balance, you know, the plaintiff often has a more compelling case in a state secrets case than the trade secrets plaintiff. I actually think my own view is that ultimately it comes down to a question of institutional competence and whether we would want even a specialized judge, even someone who sees these things once a year, essentially second-guessing the judgment of the director of the CIA or, you know, whatever other relevant agency head you think, you know, insert there.
I also want to answer the question that you just asked, and I think that one of the things we can learn from looking at other privileges is I think it casts into doubt this idea of moving to dismiss the claim at the outset based on a different predictive judgment that the evidence in the case will be privileged, because I think there's, if you look at how other privileges operate, there's no other context in which we allow a party to obtain dismissal of a case based on a prediction about the admissibility of as yet unidentified evidence. You don't see that with any other privilege or any other admissibility question. So I think that's one thing we can learn, and I can't really say that without speaking very quickly to Carl's point about how answering the complaint can itself reveal privileged information. I think the answer to that is just so then you, if there's a particular, you go question by question or you go allegation by allegation. If there's a particular allegation where admitting or denying would reveal a state secret, you say so. You say the answer to this, you know, allegation is privileged. Then you have the court look at the specific allegations that you have made that privileged claim. You submit to the court what your answer would have been in camera. The court looks at it, and based on whatever, you know, evidence that you submit to the court makes a determination. Okay, is the answer to that allegation privileged or not? And so there's a way to move forward with a case, even at the answer stage.
I just like to briefly answer Carl's last question, and I would like a judge to make a determination there. I recognize that institutional competence is a problem, but I think the way in which the privilege has been applied and used over the last number of years is also a problem, and in many ways a bigger one, because I think many people have lost confidence that the government is acting in good faith here. And that's a serious problem that stems beyond just each individual case. And so when we're trying to craft a solution, we have to recognize that the current system is broken. And it's broken for the two reasons that I just described. One is that the government doesn't really have much confidence in judges and institutional capacity and competence. And the people have lost faith that the government is acting with the best interest in mind. So we have to craft a solution that solves both of those problems, not just one.
And, I mean, I would just add, I mean, the CIA director is in a kind of conflict of interest, and I would think that you would have more public confidence after some sort of a fair proceeding. I mean, I don't at all doubt that there are many legitimate state secrets, and, in fact, one of the worries is that there may be such cynicism about overuse of state secrets that we may lose the ability to recognize a real state secret when we see it. And that was one of the reasons why I think that the harms should at least be laid out in some sort of legislative or policy guidelines. So it isn't simply the CIA director saying it's a secret. It's a conversation. It's an appeal to reason, and I do think that judges assisted by experts can contribute to that process.
The one thing I'd say there is, at least in my experience, every privilege assertion I saw would have easily satisfied whatever non-exhaustive list of what counts as a secret that you would include. I mean, what typically, at least we did under my watch, was you would articulate the information over which you were asserting the privilege, and then you would articulate, sometimes in considerable and painstaking detail, the harms from disclosure. And, you know, the many different kinds of harms were always of the sort, and I always thought they were quite legitimate, but were certainly of the sort that would have been in a non-exhaustive list. That, I mean, I'm sure you and I could come up with a really good list. So, I mean, my view is, I wouldn't oppose that being in a statute, but that in practice, every assertion I've seen would have easily satisfied that list.
I just have to follow that up with a sort of a story from when, after my first year of law school, I worked in California for a legal aid society, and I represented people who had been evicted from their apartments. And I, over the course of the summer, probably represented 40 different clients, and in each case I was absolutely convinced that the law was on my client's side and my client was right. And at the end of the summer I had a client who had burnt down his apartment on purpose. And I was convinced that he should not have been evicted. And I thought, uh-oh. And it was my first lesson in how when you represent a client, your worldview changes. It just does. And I don't, and this is nothing against Carl, who I have worked with and who was my boss and who I think has as much integrity as any government lawyer I've ever worked with. But I think when you represent a client, you lack a certain objectivity. And I think it's important for that reason to have the judge looking more critically at these claims and to have adversariality where possible.
And I mean, Liza did it very well, but I'm going to say something slightly different, which is, you know, if that's true, then there's really little to fear from going before a judge and making that claim and having the judge have some special expertise or training and would likely come to the same conclusion. But also, going that extra step and having an extra set of eyes make the assessment would add to the public confidence that what you say is actually true, that this is a legitimate claim. And I think that's a very important thing. And if we're talking about a situation where all the claims that get made are largely based on merit or based on merit, then, and we have a process that it's not just the government saying that, but an impartial judge, then, you know, I think that's a far better situation than even if it's true and just the Justice Department making those claims.
Liza, you mentioned before that you'd want to sort of talk a little bit about the balancing issue. Do you want to?
Let me see if I can do it really quickly, because I know we should probably be getting to questions. But on the issue of whether or not there should be a balancing test between national security and public interest, and this is truly blue sky because I do think the Supreme Court has spoken to this already, and that they have said there is not. But if I could change that, would I? And that gets to me to a very interesting question, which I find that there's surprisingly little discussion of, which is what do we mean by national security? And there's been a lot of talk about the proper standard for the privilege. Should it be significant harm versus substantial harm? Should it be reasonably likely versus probable? And yet the one term that has the most influence on the scope of the privilege, and that's national security, is the one that we rarely talk about. And I think if you interpret that term literally to mean that the nation itself is at risk, the government could fall, the economy could collapse and never recover, then, you know, it's hard to imagine really the purpose of a balancing test under that scenario, because in every case the public interest is going to be on the side of non-disclosure. But I'm a little concerned that national security has come to mean any harm to a U.S. Person or property that comes from outside, that comes from a foreign agent, whatever that harm is. And I think that if you define it that way, then you can have really vast illegal and very, very concerning government activity that can be concealed in the name of preventing a comparatively minor harm. And that is not to say to at all downplay the significance of a terrorist attack, any terrorist attack, regardless of how the particular harm in that case, but the fact remains that we weigh the interest of justice against potential harm to persons and property all the time. The exclusionary rule is a very good example. I mean, in the exclusionary rule, when you have a criminal defendant who is by all indications as guilty as sin, we still sometimes let those people go if there's been a bad Fourth Amendment search. And we do that at risk to the public safety, but we do it not because the Fourth Amendment says you must exclude evidence, but because there's been a judgment by the courts that that the having an effective way of enforcing that amendment is worth sort of the risks that are entailed. So I think given how broadly we all seem to be construing the term national security these days, I think a balancing test actually might be in order, which I don't think I would say if I really believe that national security was being very narrowly and strictly interpreted.
I have one more question for the panel, and then I'd like to include the audience. So if you'd like to ask a question of the panel or insert yourself into the conversation, please do move to the microphones. My question is, there's an assumption, I think, pervading all discourse about the state secrets privilege, that there comes a point in any state secrets case where if the government can surmount whatever burden we agree is the correct burden, the lawsuit goes away. And I guess my question is, are we so willing to give up on the possibility that we could create some kind of ultra-secret specialized process for those cases that under current law would end up not going forward, in the notion that some procedure before some tribunal, no matter how secretive and how sensitive, is better than nothing?
Can I take a stab at both the assumption and perhaps then the question?
Please.
There are at least some cases where you can remove the information from the case and it can still be litigated, right? So, I mean, I do think Liza's earlier point is a good one, and that is, you know, I think the government spends a lot of time focusing on the question of whether the case can be litigated absent the particular piece of information, and sometimes it really is a particular piece of information, a contract with the government that is ultimately irrelevant to the underlying dispute, et cetera. So I think there are cases where that happens, but I don't think that's really your question. Your question is, in those cases where the information is central to the claims, can you do something? And, an issue that we confronted, and again, I think my answer is it may depend. The issue we confronted is something as simple as if the plaintiff were to win at the end of the case and there had to be a judgment in the plaintiff's favor, would that fact disclose information? Let's say it was a surveillance case. Well, that probably meant that he or she was surveilled and unlawfully. And in certain circumstances, that would actually disclose information. So I think you have to look at what the result of these proceedings would be, and that's something we struggled with from time to time. My own personal view is that there are appropriate contexts for specialized proceedings, whether it's to have a court or a judge in a district who has a expertise in these issues to assess the state secrets assertion, or, you know, in appropriate cases to, say, try a small piece of fact. The circumstances where I saw this were like in government contract cases where there were already cleared counsel for the company, and you really couldn't litigate the claims in public. You didn't want to disclose that there was this weapon system or whatever, but the parties figured out a way to do it in a, you know, private arbitration or perhaps under seal or something like that. So my view at least is there are certain circumstances where it makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, there may be a role for some sort of compensation with some confidentiality clause if that's necessary. But I also think that, that's obviously important. And, you know, Heather Sawyer talked a little bit about the Arar case, which was settled. So we didn't actually go through the state secret process. Of course, they, spent 2 years going through it with the Commission of Inquiry. But even if you had that, and Bobby Chesney, I think, has suggested it, I would also want to see something on the accountability side so that, it isn't just kind of buying off people that have been mistreated. There also needs to be a heads up to either the legislative committee or the inspector general or someone who can then conduct, if necessary, a secret investigation into any governmental wrongdoing.
I guess the way to perhaps put it is, does there come a point where all questions about the state secrets privilege are really a quest for second best solutions? Right. Sir?
Yeah. I'd like to address what I think is an intersection between Liza's raising the possibility of a balancing test and Carl's emphasis on the competence, special competence, of the intelligence community experts. I think his emphasis on their competence in terms of the state secret, their special competence, is grossly overstated for two different reasons. In the first place, it's contrary to fact. The executive order for classification involves predictive judgments. You're to stamp something secret or top secret or confidential depending on the degree of harm that would occur if it was disclosed. And there is a Niagara of evidence from, as I said, Rumsfeld, Gates on down, that maybe up to 50% of the stuff that's classified is overclassified. So their record in prediction is not that persuasive. And when I was counsel to President Carter, there were rumblings that Bob Woodward, I was counsel for oversight of the intelligence committee, community, and there were rumblings Bob Woodward was about to print something that would bring down the heavens of the national security establishment. But the executive did not try to stop it, and it was a front page story entitled No Beef, which was the CIA code for the fact they had been paying King Hussein of Jordan for decades. And in fact, the sky didn't fall and he stayed king. He wasn't assassinated. He continued to cooperate with us. Pentagon Papers, similar situation. The second thing is what Lysa said about attorneys inevitably believing in their client operates at the level of the intelligence expert, because when you're working 24/7 on an issue and stamping everything secret, as a matter of human psychology, you're going to tend to think that if this ever got out, the world will come to an end on a much more exaggerated basis. Justice Judge Wisdom, in a very good opinion, albeit in a FOIA case, made a persuasive case that if an expert could not explain to a judge why it was going to be so harmful to let it out, it was doubtful that it was going to be that harmful. And in fact, if, and I'll get to Lysa in a second, if it's true that their competence is so unique and special, then all of the levels of Justice Department approval by non-intelligence experts is sort of surplusage or window dressing, because they can't understand it and guess it or vet it as much as the assertions by the experts. But what that brings me back to is the importance, the notion of significant harm. As Lysa said, you could use the words important, significant, great. I don't know if it amounts to a hill of beans. It's in the eye of the beholder. Maybe like the obscenity case, you'll know it when you see it. But what does that mean in terms of it being important? For the guy at the end of the line, it's tremendously important. So I wonder what you think of a balancing test that says it has to be significant harm greater than the harm in the judge's mind if the case is not fully litigated. And I would simply add that I don't think expanding national security only means harm to our economy. It also means harm to the Bill of Rights, harm to the country's confidence in the judicial system, et cetera. And I wonder if to give flesh to the word significant, which really doesn't mean much, a balancing test wouldn't do the job. But I do think you're grossly overstating the criticality of the expertise of the intelligence people.
Well, thanks for the question, which I guess is to me. You know, there obviously is a lot of evidence that there's overclassification. The thing I would say in response is there are a lot of original classification authorities out there, pretty low, not low level, but relatively low level. And the state secrets privilege, because it has to be asserted by the head of an agency, because it's signed under oath, penalty of perjury, I think a lot more thought goes into asserting the privilege and the justifications for doing so than some analyst in the CIA thinking about a piece of document in his or her relatively small world. So it's not clear to me that anyone has ever said or that there's demonstrated proof that there is over-assertion of the privilege. And people may think that because of cases like Arar, with which people disagree, but the actual assertion in Arar, I actually think, was pretty well established, having seen it. But the broader point.
In questioning the judge's ability, you were not talking about the Attorney General. You were specifically touting the unique expertise of the intelligence experts. So the fact that
right.
They are the ones who are classified indicates their predictive capabilities aren't so great.
Well, no, I mean, I just don't disagree. I don't agree with that. I mean, what your point was, people make predictive judgments every day in classified information, and we know for a fact that there's overclassification. I'll take that as a fact. My point is that the assertion of the privilege is a much more important, higher-level decision that gets vetted much more than any classification decision does. And so, you know, the Arar case, the privilege was not asserted by some mid-level person at the CIA. It was vetted all the way up through the relevant agency, and I don't mean DOJ. I mean, you know, whatever agency had control over the information. But let me get to the broader point, which is the balancing test. One thing that we haven't talked about, maybe people talked about earlier, but is I mean, do we actually want judges on the other side of the scale weighing the relative importance of plaintiff's claims? I mean, we've talked about, you know, how important is this information to national security? But do judges really daily go through and sort and sift how important plaintiff's claims are? I mean, was Mr. Arar's claim more important than Mr. Muhammad's and Jefferson?
That's certainly part of FOIA is determining the public interest, and I think that would be in certain there are public interest weighing claims that happen in FOIA all the time, and the judge is in the position to make that, and in a lot of other circumstances as well. And I think the question is what the weighing test is, and is the weighing test are you balancing it against how important this plaintiff is? No. Are you balancing it against the public interest in disclosure? Not an uncommon.
Okay, but is that the test?
Is it in the law under FOIA that the judge will balance? It's explicitly in the law after the 73 Amendment that the judge will balance
the public interest. The public interest.
The public interest.
Well, but I thought we were talking about before how important the plaintiff's claims were. Right? I mean, are we weighing the public interest in disclosure of the information at issue? Okay, well, that's actually not the plaintiff's claim. I mean, that is how important the how important it is to the public to know the information that's being sought. Well, yes, in FOIA cases, the judges do that. But it's not clear to me that they do the former, which is weigh the relative importance of different kinds of plaintiff's claims.
Why don't we move on to the next question?
Oh, thanks. Sean Shank, I'm here with the school's national security law brief. And I had a question for Mr. Goudet or Goud, if I'm okay. Sorry about that. At the beginning, you mentioned the idea of having district judges, or federal judges, that have had prior expertise or prior experience and national security law expertise handling these cases. People also suggested that the adversarial process or something like it is a good thing, and after what I've learned today, I'd have to say that I lean toward it as well. But ultimately, it's going to come down to the judge's own perspective on it and his ability to balance the facts, taking into account Professor Roach's mention of balancing expertise and fairness, and just something you had suggested about an ongoing education process for these judges. What exactly do you envision when recognizing that education may have to come from self-interested sources in government security apparatuses?
You mean, how would they be trained in how do I envision
on the ongoing
training?
Basis.
Yeah. Well, I imagine that if this was something that was became actual policy, that they would set up an annual ongoing training program. I mean, I think that's probably the among the lowest concerns that I would have, or relative issues about that, because I mean, I think if you're worried that they would be trained by people who are going to somehow slant them in favor of viewing information with greater national security interest or greater harm towards disclosure. Is that where you're going? Or
That's part of it. Just making sure that they have the genuine expertise and can balance.
Right. There are a lot of district judges, and they're not selected based on this criteria now. I mean, national security law experience is not very high on the list of when federal judges are nominated. But I think it should be. And were we to move to a system that was, as we have now, or as we are experiencing now, especially over the course of the last 10 years or so, where so many more cases that come before the court are dealing with these difficult national security law questions, it would seem to me to be important to elevate the previous experience in national security law as one of the criteria that's used to select federal judges in the first place. And then once that is established, if the Judicial Conference could come up with a program for continuing education and improving that as process goes on.
Can I quickly respond to that suggestion of having a specialized judge? I sort of come out against that because I feel like to some degree, elevates the facts surrounding national security determinations to some kind of magical, or not magical, but to some kind of special status. And I think that national security determinations, like anything that requires a lot of expertise, they can be very complicated. They can require a lot of background knowledge, but they're not different in kind from other forms of expertise that we rely on judges every single day to get up to speed, and they have a lot of tools to help them do that. They have special masters that can appoint independent experts, that sort of thing. And I'm not sure I see the purpose in having, not only do I not see the purpose in having, if we're going to have a special judge for state secrets, we should have a special judge for toxic torts. I mean, these are cases that require just crazy amounts of expertise, and we don't have special judges for that. But I also think it could potentially be harmful in a couple of ways, and one is this kind of, I think it's important to demystify national security as an area of expertise that's somehow different from any other area of expertise. And then secondly, I think there is the problem, whether you call it capture, whether you call it, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? And I think if you immerse somebody in a particular world, they're going to start to see things differently. Perspective is important. It's useful. And I think we want our judges to have a good perspective on these cases, as in all others.
If I could respond to that, but just briefly, I think that there's a lot to be said for not elevating national security above all other areas of expertise. But there's also, I think there's many times when, especially when you're talking about even getting out of the judicial realm, but into the members of Congress, who just have no idea how to read a piece of classified information or a raw intelligence report. Don't know what it means. Has no idea of how they can assess whether this particular piece of intelligence is more valuable than something else because they've had no experience with it. And I think that's a terrible thing. And so when we're talking about, of course you could break down every area in which a judge would have to make a ruling on into areas of specialized expertise. But in this particular case, with the seriousness with these kinds of cases have gripped the country and with the consequences that they may have, and with the relative ease in which it is to train somebody to be able to figure out what a classified, how to read a classified report and assess it whether or not it's accurate or not, or an intelligence report, it seems to me to be well worth that.
But the judge gets the consequences. I mean, that's not the hard part. The hard part isn't convincing judges that national security is important. The hard part is understanding the facts and how the facts, that's where the expertise factor comes in. And on that, and I'm not disagreeing that national security, the stakes in national security cases may be higher, depending on how we define national security, than in toxic torts cases. But I think in terms of where the expertise comes into play, is in sort of analyzing, as you said, analyzing an intelligence report or whatever, and that is the kind of skill that analyzing a chemical analysis of a plant, I think, is equally difficult and challenging, and we have mechanisms in place to get judges up to speed on those kinds of things, but I should stop.
Thanks. I guess the honor of our last question goes to Lou.
Okay, question for Carl out. Theoretically, it sounds interesting for you to say that the head of a department should be able to sign off that something is a state secret and they do it under oath. So it sounds like it's some accountability there, but I would like you to say that someone like the Secretary of the Air Force, Finletter, would actually take the time to go through that very, very lengthy accident report and read it with care to decide on line by line and paragraph by paragraph what might be a state secret. I think it's a completely implausible scenario. And I also think that the factor of bias, which you didn't talk about, the Air Force doesn't want an accident report let out that obviously shows negligence on the part of the government. And another bias is that they saw this apparently as a good vehicle to establish the state secrets privilege. So they had another bias. That's one point for you. And the other one on the balancing test, we did have that in the El-Masri case. We had in both district court and in the Fourth Circuit. And in both cases, the balancing test was, I think both courts realized something awful happened to El-Masri. Somebody got picked up in Macedonia and was taken to Afghanistan for no good reason. So they both were kind of sympathetic, but then they had a balancing test. And the balancing test was on one side of the scale was El Masri. And Lisa, remind me, this on the other side of the scale, one case was the national interest, whatever that is, and or the other one was the collective interest. So we're talking about national security, collective interest, and these concepts that, for me, it wasn't El Masri against the collective interest or the national interest. It was El Masri. I don't want to be an El Masri. I don't want to be picked up by someone thinking my passport is invalid or that I'm somebody in Hamburg at it itself. So these balancing tests, although we kind of like the notion of balancing tests, they can be as unfair as anything because we don't know what we're talking about.
In my experience, and I can only speak to the things I saw with respect to the work that went into the assertion of the privilege, the cases I worked on were not cases where the information was, a line-by-line analysis of a particular document, something like an accident report. It was a more general question, like, is there a program of the kind alleged by the plaintiff? Is there a relationship between the United States and this country in this respect? Do we have this ongoing diplomatic discussion with this entity or whatever? And so the question was somewhat more general than a line-by-line analysis of the accident report. And in my experience, the heads of the agencies with whom I dealt actually devoted considerable personal attention to the issue, but it was a different kind of inquiry. I mean, hypothetically, is there a classified intelligence program of the following variety that, hasn't been publicly disclosed? And that question goes, it goes up to the head of the CIA. Would it harm national security if this were disclosed? That question is a different kind of question than going line by line through an accident report. But even as to that more general kind of question, my experience was the heads of the agencies devoted a lot of time to the issue.
I mean, on balancing tests, obviously any test can be misapplied. But if you read the British judgments in the Binyan Muhammad case, which a lot of people have talked about, Jepson, same person, British side, they conceive of the public interest much more broadly. So it isn't just Binyan Muhammad; it's democracy, accountability, contributing to public debate. So it's a fairly robust idea of what is on the other side. And in Canada, the statutory test is the public interest against disclosure balanced against the public interest for disclosure. So, I mean, it is vague, but I think it's much more than just the individual's claim, but it includes the individual's claim.
One last question.
Very quick. In the past, there's always been a question of whether a state secret can be shared with a federal judge. Do any of you think that there is a secret so great that it would justify the executive branch in refusing to tell a federal judge a state secret for the adjudication of a case?
No. And it's not a matter of how great the secret is. It's a matter of why would we trust human beings who work within the executive department and not trust human beings who work within the judiciary? The people who work within the judiciary have been subject to, if anything, a much more rigorous sort of testing of their integrity and reliability than a number of the people within the executive branch who have access to pretty high level classified information. So it just doesn't make sense to me why you would ever keep a federal judge from looking at the evidence.
Yeah, I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I mean, the circumstance where you might think twice about it would have to do with something the judge, very specific to the judge, post-confirmation. We had a real concern about the particular judge. But I can't conceive of any secret that is so important that the right judge shouldn't get it.
Although I don't know, if the world really is ending December 21st, 2012, I don't know that we'd really want to tell a judge about it.
Everybody knows that now.
Maybe if the classified evidence is that the judge is in fact a terrorist, then yeah. Maybe not. But
Or as one of my students put it, there's always the fear that the terrorists will kidnap the judge. Well, you all have been extremely patient. I want to thank you, and I hope you'll join me in thanking our panelists for a fascinating conversation. And to reward your patience, I believe there are drinks and snacks out in the foyer outside, so I hope you will go help yourself. Thank you very much.
You're an asshole.